chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Rest make dab in the middle of it. Rest make dab in the middle. We are rest make dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got a really fine guest with us this evening, and my gosh, I can't say anything more about this gentleman. He's written some fine books. His name is Stephen Kinzer. Welcome to our program, Stephen Kinzer.
Always great to be with you.
Well, I'll tell you what, tell us a few of the books that you've written in the past, and then we'll get into this latest book.
I started out writing a book many years ago about how the United States overthrew the democratic government of Guatemala in 1954, and all the terrible consequences that had, not just for Guatemala, but also for the United States. I wrote another book called All the Shah's Men about how the United States overthrew the democratic government of Iran in 1953, and how that set Iran in a downward spiral towards tyranny for the next 60 years. Later on, I wrote a book called Overthrow about the 14 times that the United States has overthrown foreign governments. As I was doing a lot of this research, I kept coming across these same two figures, and I wondered why there weren't more books written about them and why they've been so forgotten. They're the ones that pushed us into this constant war footing way back in the 1950s, and my new book is the biography of those two extraordinary brothers, John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles.
Right. You know, you've got an excellent review just recently at the Boston Globe, and we'll have that up on you on the website as soon as we can get it. We just got it this afternoon. But there'll be a plethora of other different click-offs to where we can get, where you can get this book and so forth. But this is really an exciting book. You said that these two brothers kept cropping up, what, one as Secretary of State and the other as Director of the CIA. But earlier, well, what were their beginnings about? How did they begin their careers and so forth?
I talk a lot about this in my book because although this book is a biography of the Dulles brothers, it actually uses the framework of biography to try to ask a larger question, which is, why does the United States behave the way that it does in the world? Why are we like this? Why is it that every time there's a crisis in Burundi or Bangladesh or Belarus or Belize or Bhutan, we feel like we've got to find out what side we're on, and we've got to go in there, and we've got to force the people in that country to do what we want. What drove us to this? So I see the Dulles brothers as really vessels of American history. They reflect so many of these impulses. If you go back to their childhood, you see at the very beginning, they were born into a really extraordinary family. Their grandfather had been Secretary of State in the 1890s. In fact, he was the first Secretary of State to collaborate in overthrowing a foreign government, which was the government of Hawaii in 1893. Their uncle, Robert Lansing, was Secretary of State during World War I. So they grew up in this very rarefied environment. When they were just 10, 12 years old, they were sitting at dinner in Washington with Andrew Carnegie and Grover Cleveland and Woodrow Wilson and cabinet members and ambassadors. So they learned the patterns of thought that shape the American ruling elite. That was one factor that played into shaping their characters. The next also had to do with their family background, but in a very different way. They came from a long line of missionary Calvinists. Their father was a clergyman, the grandfather was a clergyman who had gone to India to preach the gospel, and great-grandfathers and so forth had all been missionaries. Now, they grew up in a parsonage surrounded by this missionary environment, and it taught them one central lesson, which is a central premise of traditional Calvinism, and that is the world is divided between good and evil. There's good forces and there's evil forces. And number two, a good Christian is not allowed to stay at home and just watch as this battle unfolds. Christians have to go out in the world and make sure that good triumphs over evil. That's what missionaries were all about. So it is a very short step from believing that about religion to believing something similar about politics, and that is there's political forces in the world that are good, and there's others that are evil. And it's the obligation of those of us that are good to go out into the world and fight against evil. So they developed this interventionist mentality probably before they even knew how to spell that word.
Right. They also had powers and they're in positions of power where they could start projecting a rising American power dynamo. Is that correct, too? Would that be fair to say?
It's absolutely correct. And they rose to power not in the way that ordinary people like you and I would think that people rise to power in America. You start by running for the school committee, then you run for the city council, next thing you know, you're mayor, you become a congressman, and then you rise up to very high power. That's the way people rise to power for us innocent naive. Actually, they rose to power in a much more effective way. They became lawyers for the biggest and most powerful corporate law firm in America, Sullivan and Cromwell. This is no normal law firm. They can draw up a contract for you if you want, or they can defend you in a court case if you want, but that's not their specialty. The specialty of Sullivan and Cromwell was pressuring weak countries to accept arrangements and laws that would benefit giant American corporations represented by the Dulles brothers. So as private lawyers, they grew up learning how to use economic as well as political power to push around other countries in order to obtain benefits for the companies that they defended. So they developed this combination of, on the one hand, this missionary idea that you have to go out into the world and do what's good. And on the other hand, how do we know what's good? What's good is what benefits these giant multinational corporations who the Dulles brothers spent most of their lives defending. When you understand this, it's not so surprising to see how they developed into this interventionist team that led America into so many disasters.
Yeah, you seem to say also that there was this individualism versus collectivism, that they were targeting the collective nations, and they believed in the right to own your own home and possessions and so on, and that's what also drove them.
That's certainly true, but I'd put it a little differently. I think what they believed was countries should be like the United States. If you have some kind of other cultural or political or economic perspective, Americans should go over to your country and fix it and change it. They believe there's one good way to arrange countries, and that's the way the United States is arranged. It was impossible for them to imagine that the system Americans developed for themselves might be very good for us because of our character, our history, our geography, the needs of our people, but that doesn't mean it applies to everyone. This was something they could never conceive. They believed every country should be more like the United States. And if any country sought to limit the ability of giant American corporations to operate within their borders, if countries tried to impose taxes or regulations or any other kind of restriction on the complete freedom of action for American corporations, the Dulles brothers believed this made them enemies of America. So if you were enemies of American corporate power, you are automatically enemies of the United States. This put us into confrontation with a lot of nationalist patriots in other countries who really didn't have anything against the United States, They just wanted to be left alone to build their countries up according to what their own people wanted. This was something the Dulles brothers found intolerable.
So you could say that American exceptionalism, in their viewpoint, was more of American corporate exceptionalism, right? With a free market and all that being pushed out with a strong Christian belief system underlying it. What do you think?
You just mentioned the two points that the Dulles brothers thought were the only definitions of freedom. They didn't care if you exercise a total dictatorship, if you brutalize your own people. All they wanted to know was, are you on good terms with the Christian church in your country? And number two, do you let American corporations function freely within your borders? If you do that, you're a free country. If you don't, you're our enemy.
And,
my book, The Brothers, I try to explain how these forces migrated over from the private law firm that the Dulles brothers spent decades working at into the highest corridors of American power. Their ideology was called something like, you could call it liberal internationalism, corporate globalism. It was about this idea that the United States has vital interests everywhere, and we're going to go out in the world and force people to do things the way we think they ought to do them.
Right. It sounds like a neoconservatism in a way, doesn't it?
It's actually a precursor, I think, of neoconservatism. And you might also say that in a certain way, it's a precursor of what has become of the human rights movement. The human rights movement now, in some of its manifestations, also is very interventionist. Something terrible is happening in country X. What's America going to do? Let's go bomb them. Let's invade them. Let's occupy them. Let's go fix it with some kind of military power. So there's this interventionist instinct that runs through the lives of the Dulles brothers, and it's really the theme of that book, The Brothers, that the interventionist instinct has dragged the United States into a lot of unnecessary conflict.
Yeah, you have some very interesting insights and stories, and one of them is about the movie Shane and High Noon, and about Eisenhower liking that. And well, I mean, this sort of will give our listeners a flavor of the 50s in a way, because we have many young listeners, 35 to 45, and they don't even remember Shane. But do you remember Shane?
You know, I wasn't around when it had its premiere. Right. On the other hand, I've been fascinated by that movie. I think Shane is it's a great movie to watch just for entertainment.
Yeah, right, entertainment, right.
But I'll tell you a little story. I teach a course. I teach at Brown University, and I teach a course called The History of American Intervention.
Right.
And I have a little extra credit assignment. And the extra credit assignment is go watch the movie Shane, which is in a classic old Western, and tell me how it relates to American foreign policy. And the students are often quite puzzled because this is just a Western movie.
Right.
But actually, we talk about it and think about it, and you can see, and this is a point that I make in the book, that the concept that underlies Western movies really penetrated into the American psyche. That concept is fairly simple to define. Most classic Western movies like Shane and like High Noon are about a single theme, and that is you have an isolated town or a valley or a region where decent people cannot live because thugs beat them up and oppress them. Then one good man with a gun shows up. Nobody has invited him, but he knows instinctively what's right. So he goes in, he kills a few people, and just by killing a few people, all the trouble disappears. Good people can live freely again, and then he rides out of town into the sunset expecting no other thanks except for the knowledge that he helped pull people out of tyranny and give them a good life. This is the myth that propelled America to intervene in so many countries abroad. If you transfer that valley or that little town into, say, Iraq or Afghanistan, that becomes the place where decent people can't live freely because there's some tyrant. And the one good man with a gun who knows what to do, even though nobody's invited him, is the United States. We're going to go over there. And it's going to be pretty easy to fix it because we're just going to identify the few bad people. We're going to kill them, and then that'll make everything good again. This is a childish fantasy, which is great if you're a movie maker creating little cinema icons that last 2 hours. But
right.
Don't take this as something real that works out there in the great world.
Right. You know, that's very, very good insight. Do you think that one of the problems here that the brothers presented to the country is that one was Secretary of State at the same time the other was Director of the CIA, and since they talked to each other probably daily, then they started projecting these kinds of ideas through those very powerful organizations?
The 1950s was the only time in American history that siblings, brothers, controlled the overt and the covert sides of American foreign policy. So the older brother was Secretary of State. The younger brother was Director of the CIA. They had grown up together, and they had spent so much time together over so many years, working at the same law firm, defending the same big corporations, that they came to see the world identically. What this meant was that when one of them came up with an idea, for example, let's overthrow the government of Iran, that won't cause us any long-term problems, you would never have to convene a meeting to discuss this. Under other circumstances, you might get the half a dozen Iran experts from the CIA, half a dozen Iran experts from the State Department and a few other people, and sit around the table and think about and talk about whether this is a good idea or not. But you never had to do that in the 50s because the Dulles brothers themselves created a kind of echo chamber for their shared certainties, and no consultation with anybody else was ever necessary. That made it very difficult for reality to penetrate into this closed world that the two Dulles brothers created for themselves.
Right. You have in there some writings about the Cold War paradigm being a very powerfully developed narrative. Is that what they were proponents of and helped build that narrative?
It is, very much so. They were really paladins of the Cold War. But I try to go a little bit further than that in my book, and you can see a little of what I'm trying to do by the subtitle. So the book is called The Brothers, John Foster Dulles, Alan Dulles, and their secret world war. What I'm trying to point out in this book is something that I don't think was even clear to me until I really got into this story, and it's this. We look back at the 1950s as a period of peace, but actually that wasn't true. Actually, if you lived in a place like Iran or Guatemala or Indonesia or Vietnam or the Congo, you were in constant turmoil because the United States was waging war against people it didn't like in your country. Now, we didn't see this war at the time. It was waged in the shadows. But now we can understand that the Dulles brothers never even finished one intervention operation without starting another. It was a constant, unbroken war. And that's why I use this phrase, their secret world war, as part of my title.
Boy, that is excellent. That was an excellent approach. And you got an insight into your work in about Guatemala and Nicaragua and so forth in the I think Smedley Butler called Racket? War is a racket. And you've developed some of those insights by your previous books on Central America. Now, they were really active in there, weren't they?
Absolutely. And Smedley Butler, who, as you point out, he called himself a racketeer for capitalism. In fact, he once said, I thought we could teach Al Capone a few lessons. He operated in three districts. I operated in three continents.
Right.
Now, you're right that Central America was really one of the testing grounds. And I can tell you that I just got back 2 days ago from a couple of days in Guatemala. It was quite a profound experience and very much related to the Dulles brothers. So I was there for an observance of the 100th anniversary of the birth of Jacobo Arbenz, who was the president that the CIA deposed in 1954. He was one of the Dulles brothers' first targets. So during these several days of commemorations of 1954 and President Arbenz, we went over the terrible cost of this 35-year civil war that followed the Dulles brothers' intervention. There were 200,000 Guatemalans killed over 35 years, almost all of them in massacres, not in battlefields. That's more people than were killed in political violence in all the rest of Latin America combined during the post-war period. We don't hear too much about that. But the reason that happened, the reason that Guatemala has sunk into this tragedy, all has to do with the arrogance of the Dulles brothers and their sense that they didn't like Arbenz because he was bothering the United Fruit Company, which was one of their clients. So they decided, we'll have a neat little operation. We'll go down there. We'll get rid of Arbenz, and that'll be the end of it. Nothing will ever happen. Well, as I saw in sitting through these very emotional conferences and testimonies in the last few days, it didn't just end there. It went on for 35 years. It plunged Guatemala into horror, and it has pushed that country towards a failed state status that is going to threaten the security of this whole region.
Well, you know, this has created the idea of the ugly American, has it not, those kinds of operations?
Absolutely. I think one of the Dulles brothers' ideas was very important in shaping this idea, and it was this. They had made a huge mistake in tarring everybody in the world that didn't want to embrace American corporate power as a communist. So therefore, for example, President Sukarno in Indonesia, Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran, Prime Minister Nehru in India, Prime Minister Lumumba in the Congo, these were people who called themselves neutralists. In other words, they said, we don't want to be involved in the Cold War. We're not going to be pro-Washington. We're not going to be pro-Moscow. We don't care about that. We only want to focus inside our own country. We're not involved in world politics. The Dulles brothers could not stand this. If you said that, you turned yourself into an enemy of the United States. So what it meant was they completely misunderstood the force of third world nationalism, which was just emerging in the 1950s because all the giant colonial empires were collapsing. These new countries and nations were looking for a place for themselves in a turbulent world, but the Dulles brothers branded them as enemies because they refused to stand up and say, oh, we love America. All we want is having American corporations here. That turned them into enemies, and that made a lot of ordinary, nationalistic, well-meaning patriots in many parts of the world, anti-American.
Right. You also say in there that, yeah, that had we acted differently, then those people you just described just seconds ago could be our friends, and we could have built a very strong bond and relationship with those countries instead of alienating them through these actions. Let me ask you this. Do you think one of the flaws of the founding of the CIA was where they had intelligence operations and operations out there that were actually on the ground, paramilitary? Do you think that was a mistake? Should they just concentrated on intelligence, the CIA, and not had any operations, or what?
You put your finger on, I think, well, one of the big problems that has afflicted America as we've looked out into the world, particularly in the covert part of our foreign policy. All modern secret services, including the British Secret Service, which was always held up as the gold standard in that business, had a very clear separation between intelligence gathering and covert action. The idea was, if the same people are doing both, then naturally they're going to produce intelligence that is going to conclude, we need to launch a covert operation, because they want to do that. But if you have an agency that is strictly devoted to gathering intelligence, then it can be much calmer. It can look at alternatives and say, maybe we don't need a covert operation, or say, we don't recommend anything. This is just what's happening in that country. But the Dulles brothers were compulsive activists. They couldn't sit back and analyze and reflect. They felt like every time they saw a problem in the world, they got to go out and solve it. I remember in one section of the book where I talk about Nasser, the nationalist leader who became the strongman in Egypt in the 1950s. He started flirting with the Soviets because the Americans were refusing to cooperate, and so Alan Dulles told his station chief in Cairo, if that colonel of yours pushes us too far, we'll break him in half. That was the kind of power that the Dulles brothers wielded or felt they wielded in the world. And surprise, people in other countries don't like it when secret services come in and try to behave that way in their countries.
The covert activities against Nasser were not successful. Did they pursue some lesser type of mechanisms to discredit him or what?
They waged quite a campaign against Nasser, but unfortunately for the Dulles brothers, Nasser became a huge hero, not just in Egypt, but throughout the Arab and world and beyond, with his nationalization of the Suez Canal and then the attack by France and Britain and Israel against Egypt. That just turned Nasser into a huge hero. So the Dulles brothers had to move on to other targets. Now, in my book, I have a large section which I call Six Monsters. I start out this section by quoting John Quincy Adams, who gave a great line in his famous speech on Independence Day, 1821. He told the Congress, "America does not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy." But the Dulles brothers did. And so I pick out six of these monsters that they went after, and I try to show how actually in each of these cases, they set in motion processes that wound up devastating not only the target countries, but the United States. Just to cite one example, in 1954, the leaders of major countries gathered in Geneva for a conference about Vietnam. The French and the British and the other powers there all came with the same idea. We don't like Ho Chi Minh, the communist leader of the nationalist forces in North Vietnam, but he's just won the war and there's nothing we can do. We have to turn over at least a piece of Vietnam to him. There's no way to get around it. We can't defeat him. The Dulles brothers refused to accept this. And so they were the ones who decided, we're going to go to war. We're going to stop him. We're going to build an operation in Vietnam, and we're not going to give up until we've defeated Ho Chi Minh. That was what led the United States into the entire Vietnam catastrophe. If John Foster Dulles and his brother had only decided in 1954, you know, Churchill's right, the French are right, we're just going to have to let Vietnam decide what it wants to do for itself, the whole Vietnam War, as we know it, would never have happened.
Right. You state in your book that Winston Churchill advised his American friends against fighting Ho Chi Minh because he described him as unbeatable.
The Ho Chi Minh forces in North Vietnam had just won a huge battle at Dien Bien Phu in the spring of 1954. And Winston Churchill, who'd been through a lot of wars, told the Americans a great line. He said, "The loss of the fortress must be faced." What he said was, "We tried to fight. We've been in war there for years, but it didn't work out. We lost the war. Let's just admit it and not let our blood continue to flow there forever." So the British were able to pull out. The French did the same. It was very painful for them because that was a French colony. But they realized, we can't hold on to it. Let's be real and not fantasize. But the Americans, especially the Dulles brothers, loved to fantasize. And one of the things that was their among their principal fantasies was, of course Britain can't do things. Of course France can't do things. No other country can do that. But we can do it. We're different. We're Americans. We can go out there and even destroy forces that are tremendously powerful and deeply rooted in other countries, and it will never have any bad effect for us. We are now paying the price for these fantasies. And that book that I've just produced, The Brothers, is essentially an explanation of the roots of so many crises in the world today that can be traced back to the brothers.
Right. The Red Scare was fanned over and over and expanded in Americans' minds as we've got to do this to keep the spread of communism down, right? I mean, and then,
well,
go ahead.
We talked about one of the huge miscalculations of the Dulles brothers, which was they failed to understand what third world nationalism was all about.
Okay.
Now, you've just touched on what I think was another of their huge mistakes, and that was this. In 1953, Stalin died. The new leaders of the Soviet Union put out feelers to the United States. Let's see if we can't develop a calmer relationship. They even wanted to send the Soviet defense minister to Washington. The Dulles brothers were completely against this. They decided it would be terrible to negotiate with the Soviets because the mere fact of sitting at the table with them would suggest that they're not fanatically evil and they don't want to kill every one of us. You can't allow the sharpness of the conflict to be blurred. So they refused any contact with the Soviets. They did the same thing with China. They absolutely fought successfully against the admission of the communist regime to the United Nations. They wouldn't negotiate with any Chinese officials. In fact, Foster Dulles approved the prosecution of a stamp dealer for selling stamps from China, and he vetoed the request by a zoo to get a panda from China. They didn't want any contact with the other side in the Cold War. And so I think this was also a huge miscalculation. We should have tested the goodwill of the new leaders in the Soviet Union and tried to see if there couldn't have been a way to calm down this conflict. The Dulles brothers didn't want to calm it down. They felt that that would allow Americans to kind of lose their edge and begin to think about things other than the Cold War. John Foster Dulles even arranged for the nuclear bomb test in Nevada to be broadcast on American television so people could watch them and think, this is exactly what the Soviets are going to come and do to us any day now. So the refusal to engage rivals and enemies was just as big a miscalculation as their failure to understand nationalism that was coming out of Africa and Asia and Latin America.
Would the JFK's relationship with Sukarno be an example of trying to work out something with one of these third world nations that wanted to pursue a neutral path that Dulles and all of them, they undermined it? Of course, JFK was assassinated. Would that be one reason why he was assassinated, you think, to get rid of him?
Kennedy certainly had a sense that the way we treated people like Sukarno in Indonesia and Lumumba in the Congo was a mistake, and that we should try to understand this rising force of nationalism. On the other hand, after Kennedy was elected, he kept Alan Dulles as the director of the CIA, and it was Alan Dulles who told him, you know, we can invade Cuba at the Bay of Pigs, we'll get rid of Castro, he's just the one bad guy, and then everything will go fine in Cuba from now on. And Kennedy said, are you sure this can work? And according to a couple of Kennedy's aides, Alan Dulles said to him, Mr. President, I stood here in front of Dwight Eisenhower, and he asked me, would it work to overthrow the government of Guatemala? And I told him, yes, and it did work. And I'm even more sure about this one. So the Bay of Pigs invasion was not just the idea of Alan Dulles. It was an idea that was embraced by President Kennedy. Now, afterwards, he asked himself, how could I have been so stupid? And he fired Alan Dulles. Maybe he was beginning to realize that these covert operations don't really work. And I'm sure there were some people that were quite upset with that realization.
Well, how does Alan Dulles get appointed to the Warren Commission right after he, you know, right after the JFK and previous to that he was fired by JFK? How does that all work out together? How do you untangle that mess?
It's really remarkable that a couple of years after President Kennedy fired Alan Dulles from the CIA, Alan Dulles winds up as a member of the Warren Commission investigating Kennedy's assassination. I think that Johnson appointed Alan Dulles to the Warren Commission for a very particular reason. Johnson was aware that the CIA was trying to assassinate Castro and was involved in murder plots in many countries. In fact, he told one of his friends, we were operating a murder inc. in the Caribbean. But nobody in the United States knew this at the time, other than a few officials. And it was very important for Lyndon Johnson to be sure that the Warren Commission never found out about this. If the Warren Commission knew that, for example, the CIA had been trying intently to kill Castro, that would have been an interesting line of research for the Warren Commission. So Alan Dulles' role was to make sure that the Warren Commission never got too close to the reality of what the CIA was doing in the world. In fact, he essentially had two jobs for himself in the Warren Commission. On the one hand, he briefed the other members of the commission on how to question the CIA witnesses that were coming before them to testify. At the same time, he was meeting with those witnesses and telling them how to handle the questions that they were being asked. So he was successful in making sure that the Warren Commission never really understood the full background in ways that might have led them to uncomfortable investigations.
Well, with John J. McCloy on there, he was one of the, he's probably the most powerful member. He was tied into the same New York power bunch, Rockefeller, Seven Sisters, and all that. So it looked like the Warren Commission was just set up to just, let's just come down to the single, you know what I mean, bullet theory. You know what I mean? Or the,
you're absolutely
you know
correct.
I mean? Yeah.
Not only does that come out of history, I'm old enough at least to remember that. It was very clear when the Warren Commission was formed that it was formed with a specific goal. You must come up with the conclusion that it was one crazy person. Now,
right,
it may have been one crazy person, but it was certainly the assignment of that committee to come up with that conclusion. Now, you mentioned John McCloy, who was something like the chairman of the board of the American establishment. And it raises a very interesting point that I deal with in the book, and that is that it's remarkable how all during the first half of the 20th century and right up maybe through the 60s, the making of American foreign policy was the province of a very small group of people. They were all white Protestant males who had gone to the same schools. They went to the same summer camps. They sailed in the same yacht clubs. They took vacations in the same place. They went to work for the same law firms. They dated the same girls. They went to the same investment banks. So you had a very inbred foreign policy, which was dedicated principally to defending American corporate power, because the people who were in that little elite all came from the corporate world. They were gathered in an organization that the Dulles brothers helped found, and that was the Council on Foreign Relations. I talk about that a little in this book, The Brothers, and one of the things that I noticed that I guess I hadn't realized before is that the Council on Foreign Relations has a motto. And it's actually, you can see it on the cover of their magazine, Foreign Affairs, but it's not very clear. You see this little logo, and it's got a flying horse, a Pegasus figure, and then there's a word around the top. It looks like just chicken scratch, but when you look at it more closely, it's a Latin word, and the word is ubique. It means everywhere. And that is a classic answer to the question, where does the United States have to intervene? Where does the United States have vital interests? Where do we have to be sure that we only have friends in office? Where must we project power? Everywhere. That's the motto of that corporate-based group that the Dulles brothers represented so perfectly.
Or you could say it in German, Über alles.
Über alles. That's exactly
now,
what it was.
Now this, you go into detail. Alan Dulles was OSS operating out of Bern, Switzerland. And then towards the end of the well, you do make a good point about one of the positive things and good things that Alan Dulles did. And let me know what you think about what I'm saying here. But he did negotiate an early truce with the Germans that commanded the Italian and Austrian armies. Is that correct?
He did. At the very end of World War II,
Alan
Dulles helped negotiate a deal in which dissident Nazi commanders surrendered probably a couple of weeks before they otherwise would have. However, even that operation, which he considered to be a huge success, has later come to be seen as possibly an early cause of the Cold War, because this was a period when World War II was still going on. It was the very end of World War II. Alan Dulles was obsessed with the question, how do we make sure that all of Europe turns out to be under the American wing after the end of the war and none of it comes under the Soviet wing? And one of the things he did was to freeze the Soviets out of whatever negotiations he was involved in, even though they were our allies. So when the Soviets found out that the Americans had arranged this deal with the Nazis, and had not brought the Soviets into it, and were going to occupy themselves all the territory that was surrendered by the Nazis, they began to think, wow, the Americans are already starting the post-war confrontation with us. So although that one seemed like a victory at the time, it may also have sown the seed for future trouble. And this is something that the Dulles brothers also completely failed to understand. They had no idea of the concept of what we now call blowback. They never thought that their operations could have long-term effects decades into the future. They would never have imagined, for example, that by deciding to launch covert action against Ho Chi Minh They would start a war in which a million people were killed, including more than 50,000 Americans. They never imagined when they overthrew the democracy of Iran that you'd have 25 years of the Shah's tyranny and followed by 35 years of this religious fanaticism. They thought you overthrow somebody and you can walk away and you'll forget it. So I guess the people in that country will forget it too. But what happened is we forget these operations. But they fester in the minds and the hearts and the souls of people in other countries, and that explodes in ways that can be very damaging to us many years, decades, or generations later.
You know, someone in Washington reading your books and taking your advice on resetting the area of Middle East?
You know, it's amazing to me. I think that the dullest era might be ending, like, this week. It's incredible to me to see what's happening. We talked earlier, just a few minutes ago, about how the part of the Dulles paradigm was never talk to your enemies. Well, what's happening now? The president of the United States gets on the phone and calls the president of Iran. We are now – what about what happened in Syria? There was an idea that we should go to war at first. That was our president's suggestion. Let's go bomb Syria. But amazingly – there was a lot of pushback, and many Americans were against it. They kept saying, I'm having trouble finding a job, and you're telling me that I should be focused on bombing Syria? I can't remember in my lifetime when Americans were against getting into any war in large numbers. So if we are now getting to a point where we think we can't solve the world's problems by bombing, and we want to negotiate with our rivals and enemies instead of trying to kill them, that means the Dulles era is over, because those are ideas that would have been absolutely abhorrent to them and have been abhorrent to American policymakers for 60 years.
Expand a little bit on your book, Reset, and to our listening audience that don't know about that book and how that relates to just what you've just been speaking about.
I think you might be right, even though maybe you were joking that somebody in Washington is reading that book.
I'm not joking, because I think you made a great influence in that area.
So what I suggested in my book Reset, which is the last book I wrote before this one, The Brothers, was this, essentially. We've had the same two allies in the Middle East for the last, well, let's say ever since World War II, and those are Israel and Saudi Arabia. But I argue that actually those are not the best long-term permanent allies for us, because their long-term security interests are not congruent with ours. What's good for Saudi Arabia is not good for us. What's good for us is not good for Saudi Arabia. We're spending billions of dollars buying oil in Saudi Arabia. The Saudis are using that to build these radical religious schools all over Asia and beyond, in which whole generations of little boys are taught how to chant the Quran and hate America. We are paying for that. So Saudi Arabia's interests are not our interests. However, take a look at two other countries in the region, Turkey and Iran, the only two or the two major non-Arab countries in the Muslim Middle East. Iran in particular is very intriguing, because although we have developed this idea that this is the evil, hostile focus of terror in the world, the fact is Iran's long-term strategic interests are very much in common with ours. Specifically, number one, Iran borders on Afghanistan. In fact, the entire western third of Afghanistan used to be part of Iran until Iran lost a war in the 19th century. So they speak the same language. Iran has a great ability to help stabilize Afghanistan, and they're very eager to do it because nobody wants turmoil on their border. On Iran's other border is Iraq. Also, Iran can have a great influence in calming Iraq, which is just what we want. Now, Iran isn't going to do that as long as they think the United States might use a stable Afghanistan and a stable Iraq to attack them. But if we can get on the same page, Iran can help us calm Afghanistan, calm Iraq. It can help us resolve the problem in Syria. It can help us control the Afghan drug trade, which is devastating Iran. And most of all, Iran is the bitter enemy of radical Sunni movements like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. They were against the Taliban when we were still in bed with the Taliban and trying to make oil deals with them. So in the long run, Iran actually has strategic interests that are closer to ours than Saudi Arabia. Let's think about that when we're planning our long-term future in the Middle East.
Right. Boy, that's excellent a description of what's going on there. And so you're saying that maybe the Dulles era is over, thank goodness, huh?
That might be a little bit optimistic.
Right.
It's hard to be optimistic in the world, so I like to grab on to any chance. I do think, however, that maybe the publication of this book, The Brothers, is going to focus more attention on the terrible long-term impact that this instinctive, repeated interventionism has had for us. It's not a question of whether you want to be nice or friendly or mean and rotten to other countries. I'm a realist, and I'm really believing that every country should do what's in its own interest. I'm all for America, acting in America's interest. But what I want is for America to sit down and carefully think about what really is in our interest and not do things that make us feel good for a minute, but actually in the long run wind up undermining our security. And nobody did that kind of thing more effectively and to more devastating power than the Dulles brothers.
You know, Project Paperclip, how did Alan Dulles, what did he have to do with that? And then the setting up of the secret NATO armies, how did he intervene? I mean, how did he work with that? Or were those two major things that he collaborated with?
Not so much Paperclip, but the Gladio operation is something that I think even now we're still not quite sure we understand. It was a period after World War II, and this went on for decades, in which the CIA secretly set up what were called stay-behind armies in about 14 countries in Europe. And the idea was we should have a secret army waiting in each of these countries in case there was the Soviet takeover or in case the Socialist or Communist Party ever won an election in those countries. In that case, this secret army would become a guerrilla force behind the lines. So we had to do two things in order to get that force going. The first is we had to recruit the fighters. So who do we recruit? Essentially, we recruited gangsters, ex-Nazis, and people from the extreme right. And then the other thing we had to do was give them weapons. So we didn't give them the weapons, but we catched them. We hid them in mines and secret places all over Europe. Now, later on, in the last decade, studies have been made that have shown that in the majority of countries where we did this, terrorism emerged, carried out by people that were part of America's Gladio project. They were trained by us in how to be terrorists, how to kill people, how to blow things up in case they needed those skills for some future eventuality. But, of course, they didn't wait for that eventuality. They carried out acts of terror themselves. For example, those terrible assassinations that we saw in Italy for many years, many were now carried out, we now realize, by people that were trained by the Americans to become part of this Gladio operation. So we created secret networks. It actually wound up being sources of terror, even in many countries in Europe. And this has been something that is only slowly coming out. One other thing that's very interesting about Alan Dulles, and I'm speaking to you from Boston, so that I have a particular interest in this, is that Alan Dulles set up a secret project to test LSD and other drugs to see how they would be used. And among the groups of people that he tested them on were prisoners. Now, here in Boston, we just had the trial of this horrible gang leader named Whitey Bulger. If you read his biography, you'll find out, amazingly, he's one of the people that was given LSD while he was in prison as part of this Alan Dulles project. And he describes it as a nightmarish experience that drove me to the edge of insanity. So Alan, in fact, they even had one American who they tested it on in a hotel room who went so crazy, since he had no idea what was happening to him, that he jumped out the window and died. So Alan Dulles was involved in a lot of secret projects that I describe in the book, and many of them turned out to have chilling effects.
At the beginning and previous to World War II, there was some trading with the enemy, and this law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, were some of their key clients and top clients, were they caught trading with the enemy, with the Nazis?
John Foster Dulles was a great friend of the Nazi regime in its early years. In fact, as the Nazis choked down on the German people and the pogroms against the Jews began, some of the people in Sullivan and Cromwell, the law firm, decided, you know, it's time for us to close our office in Germany. We can't be working there and collaborating with Hitler. But John Foster Dulles, who was the senior partner at Sullivan and Cromwell, was very much against this. He actually had a very warm spot for the Nazis. And the reason was the Nazis fit his definition of what is a free country. Those were the two definitions we talked about at the beginning. Number one, on good terms with Christian religious leaders. And number two, open to American corporate influence. As a matter of fact, Alan Dulles had a meeting with Hitler. And at one point, he brought up the fact that it seems like squads of your goons are beating up Jews and killing them on the street. And Hitler replied, "We are only doing what is necessary to protect the millions of dollars in American money that is invested here in Germany." What a great answer, because that's all Alan Dulles needed to hear. So the Dulles brothers actually thought that Hitler was a positive force because he was so anti-communist, and particularly Foster Dulles, the older brother, continued visiting Germany right through the late 1930s and was writing articles at one point saying, "Only hysteria entertains the idea that Germany or Japan would contemplate a war against the United States."
My gosh. I mean, there's a lot more to this than the average person has ever been able to appreciate, isn't it?
Well, that's what I'm devoting myself to in my writing. I think maybe the number one comment that I get from people who read my books, and I have gotten this in different forms literally hundreds of times over the years, is something like this: "I thought I knew about American history, but I never knew any of this." Or, "I read a lot of books. I went to school. I was taught American history. I knew about the world, but nobody ever mentioned any of this to me." So what I'm trying to do is rearrange history a little bit. The events of history don't change, but we can decide what's important and what's not important. There's a mainstream history that tries to tell you the main things that happen, and then there's a lot of other insignificant things. But my role is to look and say, you know, maybe it's the other way around. Maybe some of those things that the powerful want us to think were insignificant were actually the really big things that shaped our world. For example, the idea that the United States overthrew democracy in Iran in 1953 is thought of as some kind of a minor footnote to history, that it was just a tiny little one-month operation. If you look at what has happened to Iran for the last 60 years and look at the huge confrontation with the United States, between the United States and Iran, you realize that was not a little thing. And in my book, this latest book, The Brothers, and in some of my earlier books, I'm trying to bring into higher relief some pieces of American history that Americans are urged not to focus on, because otherwise they'll start thinking in dangerous ways.
Right. We've got about 5 minutes left in the program. What are there some of the things that I left out or you left out that you wanted to expand your ideas on a little bit? Is there anything that you can think of that you'd like to add into this last 5 minutes?
I would say that one aspect that shaped the Dulles brothers was something that shapes all of us, and that's human psychology. We have this idea called groupthink. Some scientists call it reality confirmation or confirmation bias. There's something in our minds that makes us want to fit everything we see into what we already believe. And when we see things that contradict what we already believe, there's something in our brain that pushes us to try to transform them so that they fit into our schema. The Dulles brothers were very much like that. As far as they were concerned, everything that happened in the world had to do with the U.S.-Soviet confrontation. So, for example, when Guatemala decided to have a land reform program that affected the holdings of United Fruit, the Dulles brothers assumed this was a plot that had been hatched in Moscow, and the Soviets had told Guatemala to do this in order to undermine American power. The idea that land reform in Guatemala only had to do with Guatemala and didn't have anything at all to do with the Cold War is something they couldn't possibly wrap their minds around. In fact, I found this document from an ambassador from Brazil who met with John Foster Dulles during this period, and he asked him, "How do you know that the land reform program in Guatemala was ordered by the Soviets. And he answered, it is true we have no evidence, but we are proceeding on the assumption that it must be so. I guess the lesson is, keep your mind open. Don't believe the agenda of power. Make your own agenda. Be a critical thinker, and don't consume the pablum that power likes to push down onto us. This book, it seems to be about history. It's about the 1950s, but really it isn't. It's about who we are, because if you want to know who's really responsible for the troubles of the U.S. over these 60 years, I don't think you should look at a portrait of the Dulles brothers. Really, you got to look in the mirror, because they're us.
Exactly.
We are them. And if we want to change, we
yes.
need to produce leaders who more effectively represent what America's really about. Don't try to just blame a few people. We're all responsible, and we all have the ability to change this in ways that will make us a much better and stronger country in the long run.
The battle line between good and evil run through the human heart is what Solzhenitsyn said.
Well, I would say that actually good and evil coexist in every person and in every government, and they come out in different proportions depending on circumstances. There's no absolute good. There's no absolute evil. So let's grow up and get out of childish fairy tales and Western movies and realize there's a real world out there, and we don't have to be in conflict all the time if we don't insist on it.
Right. In the closing 2 minutes here, Diego Rivera's mural, Glorious Victory, and a bust of John Foster Dulles, could those be displayed together in some way you're suggesting?
You sound like you've actually read my book.
Yes, I have. Because I respect
yes,
you quite a bit, Stephen.
You
really
are. You're quite right. So at the end of my book, I suggest this. I tried to find the bust of John Foster Dulles that's at the center of Dulles Airport, and I saw the film clip of President Kennedy unveiling it in the early 1960s. I looked around the airport. I asked people. Nobody could find it. I finally located it in a closed conference room down next to baggage claim. Why did that bust disappear? I think it's because the Dulles brothers' approach to the world did not work out well for the United States. And rather than confront that and think about why that was, we just tried to forget that it ever happened and that John Foster Dulles ever existed. So we've pushed his bust away from the airport that's named after him. And this spectacular mural that the Mexican painter Diego Rivera made portraying how the Dulles brothers crushed Guatemala is now rolled up in a museum on the other side of the ocean. I'd like to see that huge mural brought back to Dulles Airport, and I'd like to see the Dulles bust brought back up in front of it so that we can bring the Dulles brothers back to life, confront what they did, and try to figure out ways to avoid these mistakes in the future. That's what this book,
exactly.
The Brothers, is all about.
Good. Self-responsibility, good and evil, is in all of us, and we've got to confront our own devils and demons and try to overcome with goodness.
Well put, sir. Let's not go out and look for enemies everywhere else. Let's look and see what we're doing to promote the problems that afflict us.
Stephen Kinzer, thank you very much for the interview, and I really respect you. That's why I read every word in your book, okay?
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it, and I hope your fans will go out and get that book, The Brothers.
We'll have click-offs on our website where they can go to not only your site, but where to find the book and everything else. But thank you very much this evening.
Always great to be with you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.